Hey all, it's your co-host Nick here with Psychedelic Passage, and I want to share what our organization does and how we can help you on your psychedelic healing journey. We originally started Psychedelic Passage to give folks access to psychedelic therapy within the comfort of their own home. And in the process, we realized that most people have no idea what they're looking for in a guide, and they don't know which providers are qualified. The consequences of sitting with an unqualified provider are dire. There are lots of self-proclaimed facilitators out there who simply don't know what they're doing. And unfortunately, facilitator abuse and ethical violations happen regularly in this space and result in lasting psychological impacts. To solve this, we selectively curated a network of providers all over the US who operate with integrity. This allows us to help you as a client by advocating for you and your care without a conflict of interest, screening facilitators on your behalf to ensure they know what they're doing, and holding facilitators accountable for their actions, so you have peace of mind that the provider you're matched with is in good standing. Instead of searching through hundreds of unvetted online provider profiles, you can simply book a call with us, and our concierge team will take into account over 20 different variables to get you matched to a trusted facilitator who can provide treatment in the comfort of your own home. We want to give you the confidence that you're sitting with the right provider for you. No matter where you're at in the psychedelic therapy journey, we're here to help. Simply click the link in the show description below to book a consult and get connected to a trusted provider today.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Passage Podcast. My name is Jimmy Nguyen. I am your host this week. Still out here in Texas. If you heard last week's episode, you heard me say that I am in Texas for my first time, en route down to just outside of Austin for the eclipse event. This is the total solar eclipse, I think, that will touch through North America, and the next one will be in about 20 years. So I'm really excited to be out here with some friends and community to get to witness this celestial event. Thanks for being with us here this week. So grateful to our audience and our community. This week's episode actually comes in from one of our listeners, and I'll read this. It says, "Hi, Psychedelic Passage. Can you do an episode on tripping alone? I've only had solo trips and they have been very positive experiences, even when they have been challenging. Some of your emails come across as borderline fear instilling people from never ever having a solo experience unless they want to have a bad time. I know it comes with a lot of caveats and nuances, which you address very well in all of your episodes, no matter the subject. I understand from a harm reduction standpoint that after a certain dosage, it's necessary to have a sitter because the experiencer is tuned into their own experience more than the external world. And simply for safety reasons, it's best to have a sitter. But many people also experience significant psychedelic experiences at lower dosages and do not necessarily have the money or resources or interest in a sitter. Would be interested to hear your thoughts." Thank you so much to this listener. I'm really grateful to be breaking this down on our episode, you know, here today. I can tell that you have been, you know, listening to our content and reading our materials, and it really means the world to me that you are having, you know, such takeaways. And so I thought it would be helpful to dedicate this podcast episode to you and also just give some good insights for, you know, solo journeyers. I'll note that we did have an episode a few months ago about solo experiences versus group experiences versus facilitated experiences. And I realized that in that discourse, I was having somewhat of a comparison between solo and facilitated experiences, or at least experiences in the presence of others. And, you know, I'll say that having been a person that largely had their first, you know, many dozens and dozens and dozens of psychedelic experiences solo, locked in a room at very high dosages. Solo journeying is certainly something that is very near and dear and close to my heart. And so really, really happy to break this down for you all today. So I think for this episode, I think we're going to talk a little bit about solo experiences as a whole, some things to think about in the discourse of, you know, solo experiences. I want to also comment on a couple of things that this listener has put forward. And then, as always, I will break it down into a couple of, I think, tangible, actionable takeaways, pieces of advice, and, you know, just suggestions that anybody can incorporate into their psychedelic experience, particularly here, we're talking about folks who are journeying solo. So thanks for coming along with me on this episode. Yeah, what I'll share to start is that, you know, I really want to emphasize, and a lot of folks have heard me say this before, but I really do believe that everyone has a fundamental human right to explore their consciousness. By that token, they have a fundamental human right on how that looks and how that goes about, of which psychedelics can be a part of that exploration. And in conjunction with that, that means that it's your fundamental human right on who cares for you during that experience, whether you have that experience solo, whether you have it in a group. I think that is absolutely your right. And when we're talking about this concept that comes up in psychedelic work, which is really tapping into your own innate healer, your own inner healing intelligence, that means right off the bat that there's no external thing or person or whatever that can be a replacement for your own inner healing intuition and your own inner healing knowledge. So just as a fundamental principle of how I look at psychedelic work, you can see how very easily solo experiences becomes, you know, very important to that. Now, we certainly do have some communications and messages out there about just like the potential pitfalls or the potential downsides of, you know, journeying solo. But you also have to remember that a large part of our community and our audience are people who are exploring psychedelics for the first time, people who are very, very new to psychedelics. And so before we get to know them on a consult call or a concierge call or connect them, you know, to a facilitator, we do try to give some broad, generalized advice, because many folks look at psychedelics like they look at other medications. Oh, I have this symptom, I have this issue, I have this ailment. If I take this thing, it's going to relieve that symptom or ailment or pain and suffering. And anybody who's done psychedelics knows that that is not how it works. It is not a straight arrow path from point A to point B. And so, you know, when I'm thinking about, you know, psychedelic experiences, I do want to dispel that, almost this notion that if you have a solo experience, you're going to have a bad time. I think that the message that we give out in that regard is very specific to this nuanced audience of people who are exploring psychedelics for the first time. And likely, if you were going to do that solo, you just have a higher chance of things potentially going sideways, a higher chance of things being psychologically difficult to endure. Also, there's plenty of people who move through psychedelic experiences very gracefully, even if it was their first time. But I would rather put out that message of a little bit more caution than to be more cavalier about it. But certainly, this is not a conversation in absolutes. When I think about, you know, psychedelic work, I think about harm reduction, of course, which you hear us talking about all the time. The mechanisms that are in place to reduce the inherent harm that can come with any type of activity. Specifically here, we're talking about engaging in a psychedelic experience. The other side of that, which is actually a little bit of like a joke that comes up in the harm reduction world, like the music world, the festival event world, where I'm working in harm reduction, you know, alongside my friends, is this concept called benefit maximization. So if you're having harm reduction, the other side of that is benefit maximization. Now, I'll caveat to say that you've heard me on a lot of past episodes talking about how your relationship with a psychedelic substance should be deeper than whatever you're going to get out of it, right? I use this analogy of dating quite a bit. Like if you are going into a date or getting to know somebody thinking, well, what am I going to get out of this? What's the benefit for me? Me. What's going on? What's here for me? Then clearly that can limit the potentially meaningful engagement and connection that you're having with this other person or this other human. So I think the same with psychedelics. So I'm just going to kind of devil's advocate myself to say that even though I'm kind of creating this distinction between harm reduction and benefit maximization on its own is just one kind of small component with psychedelics. And you can see how in a solo experience, that becomes important. That definitely, you know, comes into play. And so, you know, I also really like this person's, you know, comment about some ideas of experiencing significant psychedelic experiences at lower dosages. Maybe some folks don't necessarily have like the money or the resources to be able to get or like invest in a sitter. And these are really, you know, interesting thoughts as well. I know that one-on-one facilitation work is quite expensive. Anything where you have somebody paying 12 to 14 hours of undivided attention towards you, which like is just uncommon in our society anyways, likely will have a high dollar cost for a highly skilled person, you know, to be able to serve you in that capacity. And I know not everybody is able to afford that. That's why we have things like sponsorship programs and financial assistance programs at Psychedelic Passage. However, I know that it's within people's right to have some solo journeying and to have some solo experiences. And so I really do think that dosage does play into this, you know, quite a bit. You know, considering your dosage, considering the load and the recovery time that it has on your biology and your physiology, on your mind, your spirit, your emotions. Now, that doesn't mean that at, you know, a gram and a half, you're not going to have a deeply emotional experience or releasing of trauma that manifests psychosomatically in your body. I'm not saying that that's the case. But I do think that that in general, lower dosages or what I call museum dosages, that's not a term that I've made up. That's a term that I've heard kind of through the ethers of the psychedelic community. But this is the idea. It's kind of like a museum exhibit. Like you pay your ticket, you can go in, you can go around and immerse yourself, you can interact with that world, and then you can very easily come out. Maybe you check out the proverbial gift shop on your way out and take a memento or a little token with you. And then you can come out and move along your day. This, you know, if you were, let's say, going into a museum and checking out an exhibit, you're not spending the whole day there. You're not, you know, camped there overnight, like night at the museum. You have this very finite kind of like foray into the psychedelic experience. The other way that I like to think about it, because I live in Colorado, is if a big, let's say, mushroom experience was like a 3-day backpacking trip where you're bringing all your stuff with you, you're backpacking, you're out there, you're immersed, you're staying multiple times throughout the night, campfires, all of that, then maybe a museum experience is more like a day hike where you got, you know, a little bit of water, maybe a lunch, maybe a pack, and you're just planning on being out there for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. And so I really do like this museum dose. And I'm also a fan of people having museum or more moderate dose experiences spread out over time, but a little bit more frequently. So like if microdosing was on one range of it, almost in the same frequency as like taking a daily supplement, though there's obviously on and off dosage days. And if macrodose was like taking a more extended stay or a more extended duration, this museum moderate dose is somewhere in the middle. It's not unheard of for folks to, especially with psilocybin, which I believe has way less of a biological load and recovery time on your system. Then it makes sense for somebody to maybe engage in, you know, moderate dose experiences every 2 to 6 weeks for a period of time, couple of months, and then taking a break. I've also heard of folks who have engaged in, you know, deep psychedelic experiences like weekly for a year. But to me, honestly, that feels like a lot. That feels like a lot of integration work that, you know, needs to happen. But it wouldn't be unheard of, let's say, if somebody took, you know, moderate dose experiences, had meaningful experiences, but did so, let's say, like once a month. And I would say that that's for psilocybin. If you were doing like LSD, I think that LSD are longer experiences. And I find that the brain fog and somewhat of the recovery mentally from LSD can be a little bit longer. You know, ketamine is a different experience when I'm looking at intravenous or intramuscular ketamine experiences at like a clinic, let's say. They typically spread those out also in a period of like, you know, every like 3 to 4 weeks or so. Also, just noting that ketamine has the propensity to be particularly habit forming if you're not careful. MDMA to me has the biggest load and the wear on your body. So typically, you know, it's not recommended to do MDMA more than once in like a 3 to 4 month period. Now, certainly people break those rules all the time in recreational experiences, but in the context here, you know, we're talking about intentional, meaningful psychedelic experiences. MDMA being a substance that is actually quite powerful, it needs a lot of recovery time. And so, you know, please be very careful when you're considering MDMA. And I kind of talk about that pool of psychedelics because that is just what's prevalent and available. Certainly there's other medicines and experiences, you know, out there. But for the context of this, you know, this is what we're going to be, you know, chatting about. And so, you know, to support, you know, this listener who suggested this episode, I think you're totally right. I think that there are ways for people to foray into psychedelic work without it having to be these like big, like, you know, set aside 3 or 4 days for you to like drop, you know, into your experience. And if you've heard what I was sharing on the episode where I was talking about my personal journey, and throughout the past couple episodes, I'd probably say like 4 or 5 episodes, I've been talking a lot about developing a relationship with the psychedelic medicine. And I think in tandem with that, that comes with developing a relationship with yourself, which like doing that heavy lifting doesn't all happen in an afternoon. And so I'm a big fan of this, and I'm really appreciative of this listener who was able to send us this note here. So I'm going to break it down into a couple of things that I think about when I'm considering a solo, you know, experience. And I guess before I do that, let me further along this thought a little bit between, you know, solo experiences and this whole like harm reduction and benefit maximization thing. Sure, you can have solo experiences. Absolutely. You can go and have a whole bunch of solo experiences and likely like get a lot of benefit out of it. You know, especially if you're seasoned, like you kind of know what you're doing. You've had, I don't know, 5 or 10 psychedelic experiences in the past where you're like, ha, I got my bearings. I have my footing a little. I know the lay of the land to a degree, and then I could go and play around. So what I'll share, that if there's anything that you're learning to do for the first time, absolutely, you can likely learn yourself and on your own. To the degree that that is aided and supported by somebody else, I think that that can potentially make a big, big impact. So I'll give you some examples. I didn't learn how to swim until I was like the pandemic time. So I was like 31. Through my life, there have been so many people who try to teach me how to swim, like at least 20 different times. A friend here in a pool at the beach, so-and-so at school, took swimming lessons. I had a former partner who was like a lifeguard. So many people tried to teach me how to swim. So many people. couldn't figure it out. Couldn't tread water, couldn't swim, inhaled a lot of water into my lungs through that process. And then during the pandemic, I was with Nick, and we were in Southern California, and I was trying to get out on a stand-up paddleboard, could never get up on that thing, whatnot. And at some point, I slipped off of it. I'm in like a really shallow beach area. I slip off of it, and my sunglasses and the paddleboard starts to float away. And I'm like, okay, I have this juncture. I have this choice. Either I'm going to go get this board, or I'm going to go get help. And likely that board's going to be really, really far away. Well, guess what happened? Because of my own self-determination and my own reliance on myself, I freaking swam out there and I got that stand-up paddleboard. And I was like, wait a minute, is this happening? Am I learning how to swim right now? I think I'm doing it. And it was actually in a solo experience where I learned how to float, learned how to swim, learned how to tread water. So that could be the potential power of it. Another analogy that I have is I also learned how to ride a bike really late in my life, 28 years old. And, you know, that was one where I really couldn't figure it out. I was like in my backyard, in my alley. This is actually hilarious. I'm in my alley trying to learn how to ride a bike. Didn't want anybody to see me. It was like super embarrassing. And I'm like trying to learn how to ride a bike, blah, 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 falling all over the place. And all of a sudden, these like 4 10-year-olds cruise down the alley with the bike. I was so embarrassed. I took the bike, I threw it into my backyard and just kind of stood there pretending like I was doing stuff while this gang of kids, you know, rolled by. And it was funny because like the embarrassment of trying to learn actually was a little inhibiting of riding a bike. However, the thing that taught me how to really ride a bike was watching and observing other people. And so that's kind of the inverse of my swimming story that I'll have to share with you, that even though a bike is solo, besides my great client, Nancy, who likes a tandem bike ride with her partner, she's given me the full disclosure, her, you know, videos on our website, you know, all that stuff. So I feel okay mentioning her. But besides like tandem bike riding, riding a bike is a solo endeavor, right? And so that's an example where by observing and being around other people and actually watching actually aided and helped in my experience. And so what I'll say here is that it's not about solo versus facilitation. I think it's wildly contextual. And not only is it wildly contextual, but it's contextual on like what's going on in your life at the time. Okay, thanks for letting me go on that tangent. I promise, here we go. We're going to drop into this list here. So, you know, first couple of pieces of advice that I have is like logistical considerations. Have all of your stuff around you. I like to set up like a mat or something on the floor so that I'm really like unencumbered. If I go like horizontal, then I can like sit up if I need. Maybe there's a lot of pillows and something that I can rest on. But if I need to like roll around on the floor or move around or have, you know, big body movements, I can do so without any fear of like falling off of the couch or any fear of like, you know, slipping out of the bed. So I love the floor. I love a mat, like a mattress or a cushion or something. And you want to just make sure you have all of your stuff around you, water, maybe a couple snacks, the ability to control lighting if you can. If it can be within arm's reach and proximity, the better. Because anybody who's been through psychedelic experience knows that there can be some executive dysfunction as far as like getting anything tangible done. Like I remember a psychedelic experience where I was trying to sit there and figure out how to pull the water bottle up to my mouth so that I could take a sip. And that must have been like an hour long ordeal. You can't imagine how proud of myself, you know, that I was when I was finally able to take a sip of water. This is also like having like a watch or a clock around you, something that you can put up and down though. Like I wouldn't have a clock out where I'm like staring at the clock the whole time, but a little like wristwatch or something that I know that I can refer to time as needed, super, super helpful. So having all of the things around you. anything that you might possibly need, have it out and available so that you don't go have to look, you know, you don't go looking for that thing, you know, if you need. If possible, be in a room where the bathroom is like right there without any steps or, you know, things in the way. I remember living in a place where the bathroom was literally just like 9 steps up. And those 9 steps felt like a damn mountain when I was in the middle of a psychedelic experience. Hydrate really well in advance. I wouldn't like over hydrate, especially with psilocybin. If you were doing like MDMA or something longer, like LSD, you probably want to hydrate at like good intervals. But I'm a fan of hydrating really well, like 24 hours in advance. And then that way, when I get into the experience, my body is generally hydrated, but my bladder's not full. And that's certainly like a balance, you know, as well, because with psilocybin, which I believe to be very much like a diuretic, like making you have to go to the bathroom more frequently, doing that solo can be really challenging. Sometimes it's a part of the experience, but oftentimes it can actually be a little, you know, disruptive as well. I always invite people to plan ahead. Longer musical playlists where you're making as few choices as possible. If you are having a musical playlist, I also invite in like longer musical pieces so that your experience can go on these potentially longer arcs that line up to the pulsating kind of effect from the undulating effect from psychedelic experiences that typically happen with psilocybin in like 30 to 45 minute arcs. You know, sure, you can have 100 3 to 5 minute, you know, songs on there, but there's not as much of like a consistency or a flow. If you have Spotify, I recommend putting on crossfade. And then recommend maybe increasing that crossfade to a couple of seconds so that all of the songs can move seamlessly into the other. There's also like a volume balancing, which can be massively, massively helpful to make sure that music at different volumes can actually like coincide with each other. So this is super helpful. So you're not having to like turn up the music or, you know, whatever. So the downside is that because you're curating this yourself, the music will likely be things that you've heard before so that you're not surprised, so that you don't end up, you know, like, you know, something that you don't like, and then you got to switch or like, you know, hit next or like thumb through it. That choice of, oh, I like this, I don't like that, that like judgment mentality can also be really impeding of a psychedelic experience. The caveat here being that if you did have, let's say, a facilitator or somebody who is with you, they may have the ability to intuitively put on a song that you've never heard before if they're really present and feeling into the space. But you're likely just going to have to forgo that in the psychedelic experience, or at least like preview the music a little bit leading up to it so that you can get a sense on what you're, you know, getting into. And then, you know, I think as a part of that, to make as little real-time choices as possible. So this decision fatigue really plays in, especially if you're in a psychedelic experience and having, you know, that a little bit of that executive dysfunction, where even the decision on should I put a hoodie on or not, or should I have my eyes open or closed, or do I like the song, or how's the temperature, or do I need to get up and get something out of the fridge? Try to do all that stuff ahead of time and try to make as little real-time choices as possible. If you can limit the amount of decisions that you have to make leading up to psychedelic experiences, I mean, I imagine as a human, we probably have thousands of thoughts a day, and we're probably at least making several hundred decisions every day. And so if you can limit that, I think that would be really, really helpful. Another thing that I like to do is I like to keep my phone on, but I like to put it in another room. This is extremely helpful when you're journeying solo, and I highly avoid against going into airplane mode, do not disturb, or turning your phone off, because you may need to access it if you're solo, whether you need emotional support, whether you slip and fall, whether you, you know, hurt yourself from that slip and fall, or turning your phone all the way off. Though some people have, you know, thoughts on like electromagnetic interference and frequency and some of those things. Again, when you're in a solo experience, I would say that it's probably better to have your phone on at an okay volume, or at least like on vibrate, and then tucked away in another room. Now, this means that you should use another device for your music, whether it's another phone or maybe a computer or, you know, something like that. Something that's accessible for you to be able to skip the music if you're going along. And at the same time, you know, this allows for people to still be able to come in contact with you, or this allows you to be able to reach out if you need, especially if you have an iPhone. So imagine a scenario where if you had your phone on do not disturb or airplane mode or off, you can't use Siri with that. But if you maybe had it on vibrate but tucked in another room and you were going through a really challenging experience, you might be able to yell out, "Hey Siri, call my friend so-and-so." And maybe that would help to connect as my Siri started to go off as I was, you know, doing that. And so I think having a little bit of a tether to somebody is really, really helpful. Like, you know, I like to share, you know, from what little I know of indigenous practices, but here in North America, there are some tribes and traditions and also cultural appropriators who go out and do these vision quests. Now, vision quests and, you know, medicine quests are generally done solo, meaning you're going out into nature probably for a period of 5 to 7 days. You're probably fasting. You may or may not be doing psychedelics. I think most of the time you're not, but you're in a hallucinatory, you know, experience. Now, the interesting thing about vision quests is that you are going solo, but you're also supported in a community. Usually there's a base camp or a home camp or people who agree to be your keepers, your energetic keepers. They'll eat meals for you. They will rest for you. They will enjoy that piece of chocolate while you're up there fasting. And so what I share here is that in a lot of, you know, indigenous wisdom, particularly here in North America, there is this sense of being held by your community, even though you are journeying solo. So I think that's really important here. Like, to the degree that you have supporters, to the degree that people know that you're journeying on this day, and maybe they're sending some prayers or some well wishes, I think that stuff goes a long way. And I also think that that's helpful from a tangible, like, strategic component. And so I'm always a fan of having a designated contact and an emergency contact. And I always suggest for that contact to know when your dosage time is, and for you to set a pre-planned time where you are either going to reach out to them or they're going to follow up with you. So, you know, if I, let's say, was planning on, you know, communing with the psychedelic at like 3 o'clock, and I know that it's psilocybin mushrooms, and I know that that experience is like 4 to 6 hours. So let's just call it on the latter end, like 6, let's say 7 hours. By 10 p.m., my designated contact knows that I'm going to be reaching out to them. And if I don't reach out to them, I'm giving them the express permission to call and check on me. And if, let's say, after 3 times, I don't answer the phone, or let's say my phone goes right to voicemail, they have my consent to come by and to come and check on me. So these are just some ideas on that. And then also, you know, like, I think the being held in community is also extremely important from an integration perspective. I think the real benefit of this is like having a witness or somebody to keep you accountable. I think that that's massively, massively helpful. Have some easy to eat foods that are come down, things that you can microwave, things that you can prepare. You know, I would even avoid boiling water and stuff like that. Of course, like having a nice cup of tea after a psilocybin experience is really helpful. But remember, you're in an altered state. There may be some, you know, potential for, you know, burning yourself or scalding your mouth or your tongue. But easy to eat foods on the come down, I always share that lighter foods can keep you in that altered state, the hallucinogenic state. I think heavier foods, more grounding foods, more savory foods, more like stick to your ribs type food can actually help to like ground into your body and get you into like a more like settled place. And I think my last piece of advice here is to always do prep and integration with somebody. Always, always, always. Whether that's a formal preparation process or just getting on the phone with somebody that you really trust for 30 to 45 minutes to share some intention, share some context in your life and say, hey, this is what's going on with me. If it's not a formal integration process like what we have here through Psychedelic Passage, then at least it's chatting with somebody to share your story or share some takeaways or share your feelings and emotions that are coming up, even if they're not a person who is equipped with the right frameworks and skills and modalities to help you navigate that in an integration process. I think having somebody who is loving and supportive and non-judgmental goes a really, really long way. So I hope that any of that was helpful. And thank you so much to this listener for this episode idea. If you have any other thoughts or our audience has any other thoughts or questions or follow-ups from anything that I'm sharing here, you can always reach out to us at support@psychedelicpassage.com. And as we near the end of this episode, I will go ahead and read another review from one of our community members. This is about one of our concierge call takers, Jake. It says, Jake was fantastic, chill, knowledgeable, and comforting. I got everything I needed from him and more. A great way to start this process, and I'm ready to move forward. Thank you for providing this service. And I just want to take a shout out, a minute to shout out our concierge team. They do really amazing and fantastic work. It's really challenging or like dynamic to drop in so deeply into people's lives to forge relationships with folks that are generally strangers on the internet and supporting them through a potentially meaningful and life-changing, you know, decision if they move into psychedelics. So that's really deep work. You know, I think our facilitators get a ton of accolades. They don't get enough accolades, but they get a ton. And I'm really happy to hear that our concierge team is experiencing and feeling the same love because they're putting out a lot of good energy into this world. So thank you to those folks. So that wraps up our episode here. You can find episodes of this podcast anywhere you get podcasts, primarily Apple and Spotify. We also upload episodes onto our YouTube. We just got over 1,000 subscribers. So please go out there and like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. There's so many different ways to engage with us, regardless of where you're at in your process. And if a loving human, you know, can support you, we would be very, very honored to do that. Even for you solo journeyers out there, even for the folks who decide to take matters into their own hands, which I really, really appreciate. I hope that any of the advice in the conversation here was helpful, and I really, really look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks. I am excited to share a new offering that can be found on our website, psychedelicpassage.com, which is our digital store. We here at Psychedelic Passage are constantly thinking about ways to enrich the intentional psychedelic process for our community. And now with this digital store, you'll be able to find preparation guides, integration guides, and recorded workshops that are typically only available to our clients. We hope that this is an exciting offering, and we look forward to adding more content over time. So check out the link in the episode description below or visit our website, psychedelicpassage.com. And we are very excited to expand our service offerings to the greater community.